From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on?
I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Paul McCartney on writing songs and poems. Last year, he collected his lyrics and poems in the book Blackbird Singing. He has a new CD called Driving Rain. And rock historian Ed Ward continues his review of Nuggets 2, a collection of psychedelic musical oddities from the mid-1960s. This time, he focuses on recordings from Europe, Asia, and South and Central America. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Life is very short, and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend.
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A federal judge in Washington has denied a request from Court TV to televise the trial of a man accused of conspiracy in the September 11th attacks. Court TV sought to overturn a ban on broadcasting federal criminal proceedings so it could televise the trial of Zacharias Moussaoui. The judge said televising the trial worldwide would pose significant dangers. Airports and airlines across the country have been implementing new federal rules aimed at increasing safety. At Chicago's O'Hare International Airport, the first day of the new rules was relatively smooth for passengers. Chicago Public Radio's Shirley Jihad reports.
Only a randomly selected group of people checking in at O'Hare have been asked to put their luggage through the bomb-detecting X-ray machinery. Other passengers have managed to get through lines relatively smoothly and quickly. Many seem to stand in line almost stoically, saying they don't mind if it means everyone is safer. Elizabeth Rechten of Mequon, Wisconsin, is heading out for a ski trip to Denver.
I do think it's for the good, and I think we've been just too complacent in the way we live in this country. It's trade-offs. If you want to get there securely, you just have to trade something off. Life's a set of trade-offs is what it is.
Airline officials also are asking passengers to get to their gates 15 to 20 minutes before departure or risk not being able to board their flights. For NPR News, I'm Shirley Jihad in Chicago.
Secretary of State Colin Powell is in Nepal following his trip to nuclear rivals India and Pakistan. Powell says he's very encouraged that India and Pakistan can avert war. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from New Delhi.
Secretary of State Powell said he had productive discussions here with Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee, Foreign Minister Jaswant Singh, and others, and said he was leaving India very encouraged that a peaceful solution could be found to the current standoff between India and Pakistan. At their joint news conference, Foreign Minister Singh said India prefers a diplomatic solution and praised Pakistan's President Musharraf for the steps he's taken so far. But Singh said mutual confidence had to be restored before any progress or de-escalation could follow. India wants Pakistani action on a list of 20 suspected terrorists and other criminals India wants handed over. Secretary of State Powell indicated today there might be some action from Pakistan on India's request soon. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, New Delhi.
A 28-year-old British citizen pleaded not guilty today to charges that he tried to crash a transatlantic jetliner with explosives hidden in his shoes. Richard Reed made his plea during an appearance in a Boston courtroom where he faced 9 new charges of terrorism. In stocks, the Dow lost 78 points to close at 97.71. The Nasdaq lost 55 points. This is NPR News. A former 1970s radical faces 2 consecutive prison terms of 10 years to life for her part in a failed plot to blow up police cars in 1975. Sarah Jane Olson continued to deny that she was involved in the specific attack when she was a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army, but she asked forgiveness for the pain she'd caused. Olson later pleaded not guilty to murder charges in another case involving the SLA. Hundreds of thousands of people are trying to flee the eastern Congo town of Goma today. A nearby volcano is into a second day of eruptions. Its lava is creating fires and explosions and cutting the town in half. The BBC's Andrew Harding reports from Goma.
I'm standing right in the middle of Goma watching a house burn. It's just been engulfed by one of the main lava flows, this huge stream of mainly black lava, but at the edges here I can see some flames burning hard, and in fact the lava flow is just moving up the road towards us here. A tree has just gone up in flames there. People are standing around. A lot of people have come back out of curiosity to see if their houses are still intact, and I'm afraid to loot. There's been a bit of looting that we've seen. The situation remains extremely dangerous in the center of Goma because of the unpredictability of the volcano. We believed that it was over yesterday, then suddenly it started erupting again through two new fissures in the side of the volcano close to town. That's what seems to have caused most of the damage here.
The BBC's Andrew Harding in Goma, Congo. The Hart Senate office building in Washington, D.C. is scheduled to reopen on Tuesday, 3 months after it was shut down because of anthrax contamination. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 11 points today. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting Now with Bill Moyers, a new weekly program that explores issues, events, and ideas shaping the world. Fridays at 9 on PBS. Local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on the mend from laryngitis. I'm Barbara Bogave. With the passing of George Harrison last November, it's been a sad time for the Beatles and their fans. We're featuring an interview today that Terry recorded with Paul McCartney in April of last year, when the Beatles were back on top of the charts with an anthology of their number one hits. Before we hear their conversation, let's listen to a song from Paul McCartney's new CD, Driving Rain. This is Spinning on an Axis.
World spinning round to the next revolution. Sun going down, gonna rise up again. I watched the sun go down with some sorrow, but now I know it's gonna come back tomorrow. Ain't no reason it has to do that. It's the season of the culture back. Spinning on an axis, spinning on an axis, staring in the face of time and space. Spinning on an axis. World spinning round to the next revolution. Sun going down, gonna rise up again. World spinning round to the next revolution. Sun going down, gonna rise up again. Ooh, hear me rise.
When Terry talked with Paul McCartney last year, he had just published a collection of new and old poetry, including lyrics which he wrote during the Beatle years, called Blackbird Singing.
I'd like you to read a poem from your collection, and this one's called Ivan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dedicated to your friend, your late friend, Ivan Vaughan. Who was he?
Well, Ivan Vaughan was one of my best friends at school, who was born on exactly the same day as I was in Liverpool. And he was a really lovely man. He turned out to be a classic scholar. He went to Cambridge to study Greek and Latin. And the other important thing was that he actually introduced me one day to John Lennon, because he was very good friends with John, part of John's crowd. And Ivan said to me, come along to this village fair that was in the village of Woolton, where John and Ivan lived. And he said, why don't you come along? It'll be quite a bit of fun, you know. He said, and my friend's playing in one of the bands. So I arrived there and saw John, and so I was introduced. So it was Ivan actually introduced me to him. And so we knew each other for a long time and had a sort of mad sense of humour. So some of the references in the poem, there's a little line goes, Cranlock Naval, Cranlock Pie. That'd be the kind of thing Ivan would say and wouldn't explain it, because that was his sense of humour. So he was a lovely friend of mine, and he actually contracted Parkinson's disease at a very early age, in his 30s, which was quite unusual. And because he was so bright, a very intelligent guy, he understood exactly what was going on, and he could keep up with all the research on it. So it was particularly sad that he died at an early age. So I then was moved to write a poem, and that really then started me on the path of writing the other poems that you find enclosed in this poetry book.
Why don't you read Ivan for us?
Okay. Ivan. Two doors open on the 18th of June. Two babies born on the same day in Liverpool. One was Ivan, the other me. We met in adolescence and did the deeds they dared us do. Jive with Ive, the ace on the base. He introduced to me at Walton Fate a pal or two. And so we did. A classic scholar he, a rocking roller me. As firm as friends could be. Cranlock navel, Cranlock pie. A tear is rolling down my eye on the 16th of August, 1993. One door closed. Bye-bye, Ivy.
So your friend Ivan introduced you to John Lennon. Do you remember what the band was playing the first time you heard John with the band The Quarrymen?
Yeah, they were. They had a repertoire of kind of folksy, sort of bluesy things mixed with early rock and roll. And John and the band were playing a thing called Come Go With Me, which was a record for a group called the Del Vikings. It was an early rock and roll record. But John obviously didn't have the record, and he probably heard it a few times on radio. And being so musical, he just picked it up. And so he was doing a version of it. But what impressed me was, even though he didn't know the words, he would make them up, and he'd steal words from sort of blues songs. So instead of the real words, which I don't know, but he was singing, come go with me down to the penitentiary, which was more off Big Bill Brunsey or somebody, you know. But I thought, you know, that's inventive, that's ingenious. So I warmed to him immediately hearing that.
And how were you invited to play with the band?
Well, they were doing two sets. There was one in the afternoon when I first of all saw them, which was outdoors, and then there was to be one in the evening. And meantime, they had all this time to fill, so they went into the village hall where the evening gig was to be, and they were sitting around, and with all this time on their hands, John, who was 1.5 years older than me, had got hold of some beer from somewhere and was having a little drink. And we were sitting around and just playing various songs, and even though I was left-handed, I'd kind of learned to turn the guitar upside down and just about play songs, because my friends wouldn't let me retune their guitars, obviously. Too inconvenient for them. So I'd had to learn this left-handed method. So I turned the guitar around, I think it was his guitar, and I played a song, an early Eddie Cochran song, which was called 20 Flight Rock. And I must have done it quite well, because a couple of days later I was cycling around Walton, which was the area where I met John. And one of the friends, a guy called Pete Shotton, cycled up to me and said, hey, we were talking about you. You know, we enjoyed that 20 Flight Rock. And would you like to be in the band, you know? So I said, well, I'll have to consider this. You know, this is a big move to me. I'd never been in a professional outfit before. I'd never actually even hardly sung on stage before. I think I'd just done it once at a holiday camp somewhere. And so I said, I'll get back to you on that one. And a couple of days later, I did, and said, yeah, you know what? It wouldn't be a bad idea.
Now, I understand you missed the first date that you're supposed to play on with the Quarrymen because you were on a scout camping trip. And there's something I find so funny about that. I don't know whether it's because it's a sign of how young you were, or was a choice between, you know, the proto band, you know, the band that later kind of became the Beatles, versus camping with the Boy Scouts.
Well, I mean, you've got to have priorities, haven't you, in life?
Right. And you chose the Scouts.
Well, exactly. You know, I mean, you know, come on. No, you know, the Scouts was kind of an official thing I took part in, and so if you missed it, you know, you there was problems. Whereas this was a new venture, you know, the band, and let's face it, none of us knew it was going to lead to any of the heights it did lead to. So it was the kind of thing I was likely to pass up the band in favour of an important scouting gig. So that had to go, I'm afraid.
Paul McCartney, speaking with Terry Gross last April. He has a new CD called Driving Rain. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview Terry Gross recorded last spring with Paul McCartney.
You have a poem called Song for John. It's actually a lyric for a song that you recorded in 1982. But I was wondering if you could read it for us.
Okay. This poem's called Here Today. It was originally a song I recorded for John Lennon. And if I said I really knew you well, what would your answer be if you were here today? Well, knowing you, you'd probably laugh and say that we were worlds apart if you were here today. But as for me, I still remember how it was before, and I'm holding back the tears no more. I love you. What about the time we met? Well, I suppose you could say that we were playing hard to get, didn't understand a thing, but we could always sing. What about the night we cried? Because there wasn't any reason left to keep it all inside. Never understood a word. But you were always there with a smile. And if I say I really loved you and was glad you came along, then you were here today, for you were in my song, here today.
When did you write this?
I wrote that shortly after John died. I wrote it in the upstairs room of what is now my recording studio.
What was the night that we cried that you referred to in the poem?
I seem to remember we had some time off in Key West, Florida, and it was because there was a hurricane, and we'd been diverted, I think, from Jacksonville. We were supposed to play a gig in Jacksonville, and we couldn't get in because it was some great hurricane. So we had to spend a night or two in Key West, is where we ended up anyway. And at that age, with that much time on our hands, we didn't really know what to do with it except get drunk. And so that was what we did. And we stayed up all night talking, like it was going out of style. And at some point early in the morning, I think we must have touched on some points that were really emotional, and we ended up crying, which was very unusual for us because we'd members of a band and young guys, we didn't do that kind of thing. So I always remembered it as a sort of important emotional landmark.
Do you remember what you were talking about that led to that?
Probably our mothers dying, because John and I shared that experience. My mother died when I was about 14, and his died shortly after, about a year or so after, I think. So this was a great bond John and I always had. We both knew the pain of it, and we both knew that we had to put on a brave face because we were sort of teenage guys, and you didn't talk about that kind of thing where we came from.
Now, that's the kind of thing that John really acted out through his music. I mean, he had a couple of songs that were really about that and were were very emotional. It's not the kind of thing you really did, though. None of the songs, as far as I know, were really about your mother.
Well, no, mine's veiled. My style is more veiled. And also, at the time the songs were written that you're talking about, like Mother, John was going through primal scream therapy.
Exactly, right.
And, you know, that's going to get it out of you.
Well, those two different approaches you had to dealing with your mother's musically is an example, in a way, of how you were different. What do you think you had in common musically and were most different about musically?
I think in common, I think we both loved the same kind of music, and it was a very large spectrum. People often think of John as quite a hard guy. In actual fact, he had a very soft center, and I was privileged to see that, particularly in early days of our relationship. So he would love songs like Little White Lies, which is an old song.
Walter Donaldson, great. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful song with some beautiful chord changes. And it's not the kind of thing you'd associate with John. He was quite a sentimental guy. And I think he had to cover it up more. I was very lucky. I had and still have a very large, supportive family. I've got relatives who are breeding as we speak. but John had a very, he had quite a small range. He had a very strange upbringing, actually, which didn't help his emotional profile. He was, he didn't live with his mother. He was brought up by his auntie, and then his uncle, his auntie's his wife, Uncle George, died. And John, I remember telling me once that he felt that he was some sort of jinx on the male side of his family, because his father had left home when John was three. So I think John always felt somehow guilty about that kind of stuff. So I think I'd been more open about that, and John wasn't able to talk about that quite so well, I think, until he was much older and therapy helped him. So what do we have in common? We had a deep love of music, a love of songwriting, which would stretch from very early old songs that were beautifully crafted to much later rock and roll songs through people like Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, through a lot of Elvis Presley stuff, through Chuck Berry, who to us was a great poet. I think Chuck is a great American poet. Bob Dylan is another who we both loved. So we had a love of music. As to what our differences were, I don't know really. I don't really think about what our differences are. I prefer to think about what drew us together.
Now, your songs were co-credited, you know, in the Beatles era. My understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that many of the songs were written by one of you or the other, although the other would do some editing on the song. But a few of the songs were actually true collaborations. Is that right? Is that accurate?
Yeah, well, what happened was, in the early days, they were pretty much... the very earliest days were separate. We wrote one or two separately before we actually got together. But when we got together and actually started writing the earliest Beatles stuff, everything was co-written. We hardly ever wrote things separate. But then after a few years, and as we got a bit of success with the Beatles and didn't actually live together or weren't just always on the road together, sharing hotel rooms, then we had the luxury of writing stuff separately. So John would write something like Nowhere Man, sort of separately in his house in outside London. And I would write something like Yesterday, quite separately on my own. And as you say, we would come together and check them out against each other. Sometimes we would edit a line of each other's, but more often we just sort of say, yeah, that's great. And very often a line that one of us was going to chuck out, we would encourage the other not to chuck out because it was a good line. I had a line in Hey Jude much later that said, the movement you need is on your shoulder. And I thought that was me just blocking out the line. And I said, I'll change that. He said, you won't, you know, that's the best line in it. And similarly, I would encourage him to keep lines in his songs that he didn't think were very good. And I'd say, no, that's a really great line. There was a song of his called Glass Onion, where he had a line about the walrus. Here's another clue for you all. The walrus was Paul. And he wanted to keep it, but he needed to check it with me. He said, what do you think about that line? I said, it's a great line. You know, it's a spoof on the way everyone was always reading into our songs. I said, here we go. You know, we give them another clue to follow. So we would check stuff against each other. It was obviously very handy for our writing to be able to do that.
Were you ever sorry that your songs were co-credited? Did you ever wish that you could get the composing credit for your songs, that it was clearer?
Well, it was an arrangement we made in the early days, very early days. And, of course, you know, a lot of people don't realize that our admiration goes back to people like Rodgers and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hart. We loved a lot of the work of those people. And so we were looking for something similar. So Lennon McCartney grew up so that we would be a songwriting team in the tradition of those people. For the first few years, it was fine. And it never bothered us. But More recently, I must say, it started to bother me, because the kind of thing that would happen, in actual fact, very to do with the poetry book we're talking about here, although we've veered off into Beatle territory, Terry.
We'll be veering back in a moment.
Let's veer back soon. What happened was, the kind of thing that would spark the feeling that they maybe should be better credited, the songs, was that Adrian Mitchell, who helped me edit my poetry book, did an anthology of verse where he had my poem, Blackbird, my song or poem, Blackbird, in it. And, of course, it was credited Blackbird by John Lennon and Paul McCartney, which was just not true. John hadn't had anything to do with that. So I started to think, you know, this is a bit of a nuisance because I don't want any credit if John's stuff gets separately put in something like a poetry anthology. You know, I don't want any credit for Give Peace a Chance, even though I am credited on that. Some of John's stuff was purely John, and I'd rather it be that. So that kind of started me thinking. And then when we had the Beatles anthology record came out, I actually did request that on the song Yesterday, which was solely penned by me, that for the first time in 30 years, I be allowed to actually have my name in front of John's, not remove John's name, but that we credit it Yesterday by Paul McCartney and John Lennon. As I say, John actually didn't have anything to do with the song at all. He didn't sing on it or play on it or write it. So I thought that was fair enough. And in actual fact, I wasn't allowed to do that. That was vetoed. And I was actually in Italy, and I was looking at a pianist's songbook, the fake book that the pianist was using, and you tend to flick through and look for your own songs. You know, you see Fly Me to the Moon, very, very nice. You see Moon River, lovely. You see Hey Jude, you go, way. And this was credited, Hey Jude, by John Lennon, just because his name comes first. So you've hit on a sore point of mine there. I don't want to remove his name, but I must say, just for kind of Trades Descriptions Act, as we call it over here, I wouldn't mind on the songs that I just did without John to have my name first.
Paul McCartney. Terry spoke with him last spring. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
One, two, three, five!
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Passage by Connie Willis, available in paperback from the author of Doomsday Book. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the Beatles with Paul McCartney. Also, Ed Ward with part two of his review of Nuggets 2, a collection of psychedelic records from the mid-1960s.
I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time or place where we just met. She's just the girl for me, and I want all the world to see we've met. Had it been another day, I might have looked the other way, and I'd have never been aware. But as it is, I'll dream of her tonight. La-da-da-da-da. Falling, yes, I am falling, and she keeps calling me back again. I have never known the like of this. I've been alone, and I have missed things and kept out of sight. But other girls were never quite like this. La-da-da-da-da. Falling, yes, I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again. Falling, yes, I'm falling, and she keeps calling me back again. I've just seen a face, I can't forget the time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's continue now Terry's interview with Paul McCartney, recorded last April. He had just published Blackbird Singing, a collection of his poetry, including lyrics from his Beatle years.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night.
Now, I was wondering, you know, why you didn't include some of your early song lyrics in the new collection. I mean, even something like Love Me Do, which is, I think, one of the songs that you actually did co-write with John. Okay, a lyric like, love, love me do, you know I love you, I'll always be true, so please love me do. Now, on the page, that won't look right, but it works well as a lyric. Or like, she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's not going to read great on a page, but it sings great.
Or as my father would have said, Paul, there's enough of these Americanisms around. Couldn't you write, she loves you, yes, yes, yes?
Did he really say that?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, that's so adult.
Even though he was very working class, he was fussy about his words.
so why didn't you include the song?
Well, you know, Love Me Do sounded good the way you just did it, I thought. So, you know, the truth of why it wasn't included was Adrian, my editor on the book, Adrian Mitchell, actually chose which lyrics he wanted in it, and so I allowed him that decision. I didn't want to have to choose between my lyrics, actually. So I just said to him, which ones do you think will work best on the page? And he included them, even down to, why don't we do it in the road? Why don't we do it in the road? No one will be watching us. Why don't we do it in the road? Which I thought, he's mad to include that. But I actually did a poetry reading in Liverpool the other night, my first ever in the universe. And you know what? I ended with that and got the audience to join in, and we had a ball.
What inspired that one?
That was inspired by Lord knows what. Probably sexual feelings, Terry.
Mm-hmm. A kind of a lewd song for a first time.
For such a nice guy.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you know, but I have my lewd moments, we all?
Now, when you were growing up, your father was an amateur musician. He played piano. And I imagine he had a lot of records around the house?
No, not so much records. We didn't. We listened to the radio, and he played piano in the house. But in actual fact, I can't remember him having one record, let alone lots.
Now, did the songs that you grew up with, that your father played, or that you listened to on the radio with your father, did they affect your sense of, like, song structure or the kind of chords you'd put to a song?
Yeah, very definitely, yes. I loved listening as a kid to him playing the piano. I can still remember now sort of lying on the floor with my chin cupped in my hands, listening to him play. He played from another era, songs from another era. One of my favourites he played was a song called Lullaby of the Leaves. He used to play things by Paul Whiteman and his orchestra. He played Chicago. So I loved all those songs, and I loved hearing him. And he would actually take me and my brother, and he would educate us in his own primitive way, because he didn't know how to read or write music. He'd learn by ear. But he was very musical. And so we'd be listening to the radio, and he'd say, can you hear that deep noise there? He'd say, that's the bass. So he'd pick out things for us to listen to. And he would sometimes show us how to do a harmony. He'd say, now here's a tune, and this is the harmony to it. So in the Beatles, in the early days of the Beatles, I was very keen on us doing harmonies. And I would have to put that down to him.
The vocal harmonies you're talking about?
Yeah. I would always encourage the Beatles to do harmonies, or if John had a song, I would immediately harmonise to it. And you can hear that right the way through the Beatles' career. I'm often harmonising a third above John, or we're often harmonising as a group. So I think my love of harmony came from him actually sitting, my brother Mike and I, down and saying, this is how it goes.
Paul McCartney from an interview recorded last spring. We'll feature more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with an interview Terry Gross recorded last April with Paul McCartney. His collection of poetry, Blackbird Singing, includes lyrics from his Beatle years.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe. Yesterday, suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. Why she had to go, I don't know, she wouldn't say. I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday. Yesterday.
Love was so what, one of the song lyrics included in your new book of poems and lyrics, Blackbird Singing, is Yesterday. And this apparently is a rewriting of the very first song that you wrote at the age of 14, which is called I Lost My Little Girl.
No, that's not quite true. My very first song was called I Lost My Little Girl, and that was written at the age of 14. But where I think the confusion is that Yesterday was a rewriting of the original lyric of Yesterday, because the song Yesterday, tune of it, came to me in a dream. I just woke up one morning, and I had this melody in my head, and being by then a professional musician, I thought, I wonder what that is. And I had a piano by the side of my bed, so I actually sort of got some chords and put this tune to it. But I didn't have any words, so the original words to Yesterday were scrambled eggs. Oh, my baby, how I love your legs. I believe in scrambled eggs. And I thought, you know what, the tune's too nice to have those as the lyrics. So Yesterday is a rewrite of Scrambled Eggs.
That's funny. That reminds me of how, like, Ira Gershwin and some of the other great lyricists used to write what was called dummy lyrics. They'd come up with anything like the equivalent of Scrambled Eggs to have a fake lyric to give them the rhyme scheme for the melody.
That's it, yeah. I call that blocking in. It sometimes happens as you're doing a song. You get a tune, and it feels sort of silly going ba da dee ba dee ba do dee dee da do da da. So you just go I'm a girl da 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 somebody ba da do ba dee, and you find words just come to you. Some of which you keep, some like scrambled eggs you lose quickly.
So it went from scrambled eggs to I think the first song that the adults were doing of yours. You know, when the Beatles started performing, the adults were up in arms about them, about your hair and about, you know, the silliness of the lyrics and everything. But with Yesterday, like the nightclub adult performers started adding it to their acts.
Yeah.
Did that feel like a victory to you, or did you really not care what the adults were doing in their acts anyways?
No, it was very nice. It was very nice to have that because, you know, we thought what we were doing was quite good and we were proud of it. And there was this sort of backlash, particularly from the elder generation. People tell me stories now. They say they were watching that first Ed Sullivan show. And it's always the dad in the family who sort of says, them Beatles, and he never likes us. And he always says, you know, those are Whigs. They always thought the dads always swore the kids. Yeah, the kids saying, we knew they weren't. We knew they weren't. But so it was always the problem. The dad was always the problem. So I suppose he was symbolic of the problem. So that when people started to like anything out of our repertoire, it was a certain victory. And yesterday was a personal victory of mine. I mean, for instance, the great clarinetist Benny Goodman, who we had loved and thought was great talent, started for some reason, and maybe it was just a journalistic thing, but he came out against us. He said, oh, you know, I can't remember what he said. But of course, we hated him from then on. And we started saying, he's a lousy clarinetist. Anyway, what does he know, you know? So there was this sort of group that didn't like us, that thought we weren't very good. So when yesterday came out, I think a lot of them had to change the tune. And it eventually got recorded by way too many of them.
Right. Now, thanks for setting me straight that yesterday wasn't based on your first song, I Lost My Little Girl. But could you tell us what the lyric was to that song that you wrote when you were 14?
I Lost My Little Girl?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got to try and remember it now. This is a memory test. I woke up late this morning, my head was in a whirl, and only then I realized I'd lost my little girl. Her clothes were not expensive. Her hair didn't always curl. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da, I lost my little girl. Oh, my God, you would have to go through that, wouldn't you? Look, I'm trying to look grown up and poetic here, and you're taking me back to my worst memories. No, it was the line that made my toes curl, and that perhaps should have been a line in it. She never made my toes curl. Was her hair didn't always curl, which always got grimaces from my friends. But, hey, you know, it was 14. It's not bad for 14.
Did you have a melody for it too?
Yeah. I'm not singing it on your program,
right,
Terry. By the record.
I figured. I'd like you to read another poem from your book, and this is one of the last poems in the book. It's a poem called Lost, and it's for Linda.
Yeah, okay. One of the things about poetry for me is that it seems a good way of dealing with grief. And when I'm feeling low, when I was feeling low, particularly after Linda died, words came to me in the form of poems. One or two came in the forms of songs, but mainly they were just words, and things would happen that I felt I had to set down. So quite a few poems, as you say, at the end of this book, were words that occurred to me then, and this one is one of them, called Lost. I lost my wife, she lost her life. Until then, the luxury of no responsibility. Chopper wouldn't fall that night, as clenched inside a glove, we sucked each other's energy.
The line, until then, the luxury of no responsibility?
Yes, you know, I was married for 30 years, and in a good marriage, you've got plenty of responsibility, but if you're lucky, you don't feel like you've got any. So even though I had a lot of responsibility, obviously, with the kids, Linda was cool enough to make me feel like I didn't really have any. I had the freedom, all the freedom to do whatever I wanted. So that's really what that line's about. It's it should perhaps be the luxury of feeling I didn't have any responsibility. But it came out in that shortened version.
Your wife, Linda, died of cancer. Your mother died of cancer as well, your mother, when you were 14. My understanding is that when your mother had cancer, she tried to hide it, and she didn't tell you that she had cancer. You found out after she died what the problem was.
That's true.
So when Linda got cancer, how did you want to handle it? From what you had learned about not being told the truth.
Yes. You know, we just had to face up to it by then, because it was a different era, different civilization. We knew that, for instance, we would have to talk to the kids about it, whereas in the era I was brought up in, post-war Britain, it wasn't the kind of thing that women talked about. And there were a lot of things that women didn't talk about. Periods, for instance, were completely forbidden for a woman, a mother, to talk to her sons about. I think there are still a lot of people like that, but it was particularly that way. So when she got ill, she just got ill. And when she went to hospital, she was just in hospital for a short while. And it was all not spoken about. And it wasn't till much later that I learned that she had, in fact, died of breast cancer. So it was particularly chilling when Linda contracted it. And there were plenty of echoes that I actually tried not to notice.
What kind of echoes do you mean?
All sorts of things. I mean, my dad, I remembered my dad saying to my mom when she would get tired because of her illness, why don't you go upstairs and have 40 winks? So that was something I was very careful never to say to Linda, out of sort of superstition. You know, I just thought, no, don't ever say that, whatever you do. So I would say, why don't you take a nap? You know, that kind of thing. So there were all sorts of echoes. And obviously we were hoping that she would pull through and she would conquer it. We didn't realise how serious it was. So we stayed very optimistic and very positive right up until the end.
Well, Paul McCartney, I thank you so much for talking with us and for reading from your new book. Really appreciate it.
Good. Thanks a lot.
Paul McCartney, recorded last April. He has a new CD, Driving Rain.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her under your skin.
Coming up, part two of Ed Ward's survey of 60s psychedelia from around the world. This is Fresh Air. The United States and England weren't the only countries making great psychedelic records in the mid-60s, as Rhino Records recently released Nuggets 2 box proves. Bands from Europe, South America, and Asia recorded their own takes on the music. Today, Ed Ward takes us on a quick trip around the rest of the rock and roll globe.
In the text, words from the past, hold down the page to keep words fast, in reality to come what may. Knowing what you really say, you make your life just like a play, like I knew before would come the future. On and on within your part, evermore I need your...
The coming of the Beatles sent tremors around the world. America, that wealthy nation with so many teenagers with disposable cash, had never paid any attention to England's pop music before, yet these four guys were making millions and millions of wonderful American dollars. Everybody wanted some. Plus, of course, there was England. If you could get a hit there, you might also springboard to the States.
Monday morning feels so bad. Everybody seems to nag me. Coming Tuesday, I feel better.
Many made it, but a whole lot sure tried. One group that did was the Easy Beats from Australia, although by the time Friday on My Mind reached number 16 on the U.S. charts in 1967, they'd moved to London. Harry Vanda and George Young, their songwriters, wound up working with George's little brother's band, AC/DC, incidentally. But Australia and New Zealand and Canada were English-speaking countries. What's really remarkable is the number of bands that recorded in English, although it wasn't their first language. Holland led the invasion from the continent.
It's rattling to see into your soul. So I don't want you, because I know that I love your body, but not your soul.
Hubie and the Blizzards were one of Amsterdam's top attractions, a hard-rocking blues band with a pop edge, who wound up laying the foundation for a scene that's still very much alive, although the band dissolved in the early 70s. Scandinavia was another area where English language education started early for school kids, and while the scene was stimulated by some British bands moving there to reduce their competition, bands like Sweden's The Mascots sounded beatly enough on their own.
There is nothing else I'd rather do. I would love to give my love to you. And as you're looking on to me, I know what love could be. If there were only words enough to tell you. Once before.
Not to mention that way over in Iceland, Hljómar, who naturally changed their name to Thor's Hammer when they went international, were also reaching for the golden ring.
Well, there is something I've got to tell you. One thing that's been bugging me for such a long time. If you ever see me, babe, and you don't come back again, my life will be like it was before. Back before you came, my life was all right.
Nor was Iceland the most obscure country in the running. Over in Czechoslovakia, Tony Black, a Canadian student, had formed the Matadors, and they had quite a run. The lousy recording quality is on the original, but the lyrics are nothing next to their masterpiece, Don't Bother Me, which goes, in part, live in peace, live in peace. Stop now teaching rude things. You are me. Far out. Even further out was South and Central America. Today's thriving rock and Espanol movement owes a lot to pioneers like Los Shakers from, of all places, Uruguay.
We want you to camp. We want you to hear. We want you to dance.
And then there were Mexico's Los Chihuas from Chihuahua.
If you want life to survive, girl, you better play it right. I know the best things in life are free, and I guess it's time for you to see. 'Cause a change in the colors of life, 'cause a change in the colors of life. Baby, I can see them changing. I can see them walking all around you.
In Japan, there was a huge eruption of rock music, which became known as GS, or group sounds. And I hope to do a whole piece on this soon. But I'd like to end here with the band on this collection which astonished me more than any other.
You love me though you treat me any old way. I just wanna leave you, but you beg me here to stay. My love, the passion love, my love for you is very strong. Though I feel the way I do, I know this love can't just go on.
Just can't go on, just can't go on.
Until that chorus kicked in, you'd be forgiven for thinking the Boots were an 80s band who had too much Velvet Underground to drink last night. But in fact, Gaby was recorded in 1966 in, of all places, Berlin. Like so many of the other bands on Nuggets 2, they seem to have disappeared, but it's wonderful to have what remains.
Edward lives in Berlin. He reviewed the Nuggets 2 box on Rhino Records. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From PBS, presenting American Family, a new weekly drama from the director of Selena and Del Norte. Wednesday nights at 8, beginning January 23rd. Local times may vary. And Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the history and legacy of lynching in America. We talk with Philip Dre, author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. Join us for the next Fresh Air.